Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, August 24th, 2013, and I'm Harley Schlanger, and I will be your host today. We're at a very interesting moment in history where you can see, if you are thinking properly, the end of an empire, the inevitable collapse of the British financial empire. And I say inevitable because once an empire starts feeding on itself, starts moving toward an attack on its own population, in a sense eating its young, which is what's happening now with the combined effects of the financial collapse, the collapse in living standards, and now the accelerating collapse of the physical economy, there's no way that this empire can survive. It can't pay its debts. And this is a point Lyndon LaRouche has made repeatedly. And as a result, at some point in the near future, we're either going to be fully enveloped in a terrible dark age of depopulation, of chaos, of completely uncivilized behavior, wars and so on, which we'll be lucky to escape as a civilization, or we're going to have a dramatic change going back to principles of the American Revolution, of American system physical economy, that have worked in the past, but we're not just going to restore the past. And that's the topic we're discussing today. And let me just set the stage a little bit more, because the fight over Glass-Steagall, as our listeners know, has been escalating. And we have had enormous success in shaping the agenda. The empire is fighting back as a result, and they have an offensive going against Glass-Steagall, which includes top bankers, including Jamie Dimon himself, the man with the magnificent hair from J.P. Morgan Chase, who's called Obama's favorite banker. Jamie Dimon himself is out attacking Glass-Steagall in the media. The head of the American Bankers Association is attacking Glass-Steagall, attacking Thomas Honig. The chief operating officer of the American Bankers Association is attacking our own Paul Gallagher, in all places, in the Daily Oklahoman. There's been a war over Glass-Steagall in the California legislature, the Battle of Atlanta, and so on. And you see the bankers in a totally desperate state of mind. But the other side of that desperation is that they're stoking the fires of war with the efforts now to use this phony claim of a gas attack. And I say phony claim. The evidence has not been presented yet that demonstrates there really was a gas attack. And if there was a gas attack, the question is who did it, or chemical weapons attack. But the issue here is the desperation of the oligarchy to change the subject. And we have a report from a very important Washington source who said that we've stunned the official institutions with our offensive, the success of it. But he pointed out we haven't won yet. Now, in order to win this fight, Lyndon LaRouche has, in a sense, changed the battlefield by hitting at flanks. And one of the points he's been making over and over recently is we have to get people to see what's possible in the post-Obama era, in a post-Wall Street era. That is to get people to actually think about what it means to live in the future. My guest today on the LaRouche Show is one of the leaders of the work, a coordinator of the work being done by LaRouche's basement scientific team to define what exactly that future will look like. Ben Denniston has just completed a report that's in the next issue of the EIR titled Increasing the Productivity of the North American Water Cycle, the Nuclear Thermonuclear NOAPA 21. And we're going to be discussing this as an economic principle, as a scientific principle, but also challenging our listeners to break with the little thinking that's been induced by the empire and begin to think like human beings about what it means to function in this kind of future. So, Ben, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Harley.
Now, one of the important points that I think people have to get is that you cannot continue in the direction we're going and somehow get to a steady state. That is, you can't, that austerity won't restore growth, that bailouts won't restore financial health, and that what we're really facing is a total breakdown. And I'd like you to just discuss that a little bit from the standpoint of the work you're doing, because I think that's a really important concept for people to grasp.
Yeah, and I think most fundamentally it goes to Lyndon LaRouche's work in the science of physical economics, where he's, you know, shown in a more scientific way what a lot of people have had an understanding of historically, including some of the key figures, economic figures in the history of our own country, back to Hamilton and even before that, which is that the human species is characterized by leaps of progress. The entire history of mankind, what makes mankind mankind and not just a higher ape or a monkey or just some other animal species, the most clear physical manifestation of what makes human beings uniquely human beings is the ability to have qualitative shifts in our relationship to the environment, to the biosphere around us, to the planet, to natural resources, and ultimately to the whole solar system and the whole galaxy. Frankly, that's how we should be thinking. But that succession of moving to new scientific revolutions, which completely transform our ability to support ourselves at a higher level, to acquire the resources and needs needed to sustain society, that history of always moving to successive steps is characteristic and expresses what makes mankind mankind. So now we've had a policy for decades, increasingly since the assassination of Kennedy, and then even more rapidly since the really strong onset of the environmentalist movement, dominating policy in the United States and in Europe. We've had a policy of just stopping progress. We've had all kinds of technologies, from nuclear fission systems to the beginnings of developing a real thermonuclear economy, starting to deal with the technologies associated with thermonuclear power, that have just been never implemented, never built. And so the breakdown we're seeing now in water, for example, the water crisis, is an expression of decades of attrition, of failing to progress beyond older power sources. You know, I mean, a few of us have been talking about, I think it's not everything, but, you know, I think this whole fracking case is a useful illustration of just the insanity of this. We're taking precious water, which is a very precious commodity in the Southwest and places like Texas, the whole southwestern United States. And in Texas, they're taking this water, pumping it into the ground to try and pull out these natural gas and oil and these things with this fracking process. You're taking what is a precious resource that's needed for agriculture, for cities in these whole regions, and we're just pumping it in the ground to try and get out a resource that we frankly should have moved beyond decades ago. Now, we could still use natural gas and petroleum for plastics, petrochemicals, different industrial usage, but the dependence we have upon this lower-order resource for energy consumption, for the whole economy, for powering the economy, has not been needed for decades. We could have transferred to nuclear power in a large scale decades ago. And so the failure to move to available options has made it so we're putting more and more effort, economic effort and input, just to try and get these older resources that we could have moved beyond by now.
Well, you know, when you take away water from the food production, I guess what they're saying is let them eat oil. Now, Ben, one of the things that I think is important here is that you brought up the environmentalists and the greenie movement. And, you know, there's probably still people who are soft on this and need to realize that this has nothing to do with competent economics. And one of the theories, and I ran into this the other day, is someone was saying, well, we have to go to subsistence. We have to use just enough. And the idea that you're talking about of a great increase in energy throughput, that's just foolish, because it will use up the resources and we have to handle them better. But this idea of a subsistence approach or minimal technological development really is what LaRouche refers to as attrition, which means there's no such thing as a steady economy. It's a downward plunge, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if you're not moving towards higher levels, you're just eating up whatever resource base you have. And I mean, with the whole environmentalist thing, I think, you know, there's two points that are really important to make on it, just from the top, is, you know, one, the whole idea of some steady state isn't even natural for life itself. Life itself, historically, if you look at evolution, life itself has been moving towards more energetic states, more intense states, using resources at a faster rate, completely overturning and eliminating previous states of life. You know, we've done studies, you look at the transition from the whole dinosaur system of the biosphere to the mammalian system, you get transitions to higher and higher levels that completely overturn the previous states. The idea that there's any natural equilibrium from the start is a fraud. The idea that there's some natural balance that nature exists in is already just a false assumption.
I think one of the interesting things from your paper is that you point out that this is not only true of human life, but it's also true of plant life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Difference between the pine tree and the oak tree, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and so, for example, what mankind can uniquely do, for example, to address the crisis facing the nations of the North American continent, for example, the water crisis, is with NWAPA, we can manage the whole water cycle of the continent. I mean, there's no scientific or serious reason why there's so much water up north and so little water in the south on the western side of the continent. It's kind of just an arbitrary way the wind patterns and geological features have made it. But there's nothing natural about that. The region of the west, the southwest, used to be forest. If you go back in time, so there's no reason why this current state where you have this huge lack of water in the southwest should remain that way. And so what we have with this NWAPA program and an even more powerful version with nuclear power driving the system is an ability to bring that water down into the southwest, into the western United States, and, you know, not. Because water is funny. It's not something we're just going to use up and it goes away. There's a constant input and output of water for the whole continent. You have a constant inputting of water from rain falling onto the continent, and that rain participates on the continent for a little while and then eventually returns to the ocean to become salt water, where it then evaporates from sunlight and then falls again as rain on the continent. So you have this ongoing cycle. The question we should pose is, what can mankind do to increase the productivity of that cycle?
Well, Ben, I think this is one of the more interesting points that you raise in your paper, and I just want to identify for our listeners that you're listening to Ben Denniston, who's just written a very significant article that we'll be getting out next week in Washington on the thermonuclear NWAPA. Now, this question of the life of water, or water as productive, you know, it's what's interesting when you take this approach from, and this is obviously shaped by the work you've done in Vernadsky, that you're talking about living systems that do develop or collapse, and water is a part of that, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think it goes to some of the false assumptions people have about economics in general. People try and identify value just in an object per se. How much is this gallon of water worth in dollar terms? What's the value of this object, this amount of water? What's the value of this quantity? Whereas if you take the approach of Lyndon LaRouche in a real scientific study of the whole process, the value is defined by its contribution to growth. How much new plant life is being created by that water as it's participating on land? How many times is that water used and then reused? Because plants do some very interesting things with the water. For example, if you take there was one figure I read in one of these papers, where if you take a 70-foot sycamore tree, a nice, tall, leafy tree with a lot of surface area of leaves on top, that tree will be pulling water from down below in the water table, below the surface, and pulling that water up to its leaves at a rate of 100 gallons an hour. So in 1 hour, that one tree will pull from the groundwater 100 gallons up through its trunk into its leaves, and 90% of that water then evaporates into the atmosphere. So 90 gallons an hour being pulled from water that would otherwise just be stuck in the ground, kind of slowly making its way towards a river system or some type of runoff, you know, not participating directly in life too much, this tree will pull this water out of the ground, utilize some of it for photosynthesis, and then release a huge amount back into the atmosphere where it can then, as atmospheric moisture, condense and fall again as rain. So life itself has this interesting feedback effect where it actually increases the rate of cycling, the rate of utilization, productive utilization of that water.
Well, you're saying really that the tree increases the value of that water.
Yeah, absolutely.
Huh.
And then so then the role of Nawapa is we have this huge discrepancy, which is just an arbitrary discrepancy in the water distribution in the West. And what mankind can uniquely do is use our power of science and knowledge and, you know, applying things like nuclear power gives us an even greater ability to do this, to bring this water down into the Southwest, not just to use it up, but to take the existing cycle and twist it such that it has a greater rate of activity, actually use it to create more plant life.
Well, let's get into this whole question of NWAPA, the North American Water and Power Alliance, because this is a program that was drafted in the late 50s, early 60s. There was a lot of momentum for it during the period of President Kennedy's administration. Senator Frank Moss of Utah and others, including former Speaker of the House Jim Wright, were promoting it in the early to mid-60s. But there's a big change between that NWAPA and what LaRouche PAC has been talking about as NWAPA 21. Now, just give us a sense of what that change is, because I was really struck by the fact that if you do use NWAPA as to produce the electricity that's needed to pump the water, you actually are using up 45% of the water that you're bringing down, and that's why you've proposed that it has to be a thermonuclear NWAPA. So I'd like you to just walk us through what the original plan was and what the changes based on the technological capability and also the needs of the economy today.
Yeah, absolutely. And the general top-down picture is just addressing the whole continental water cycle as a single system. And so you had figures around the Parsons Corporation in the 50s and 60s looking at this, and they did, you know, a decent design for the time, very large design for the time, to take some of this around 10% of the total runoff, around 20% of the runoff of just a few select number of rivers up north, British Columbia, Alaska, Yukon Territory, and bring that water down into the Southwest, into the Canadian prairies, into the High Plains region of the United States, and all the way down into northern Mexico. And to do that, you have a few places where you have to go through some significant elevation changes. You have to do large-scale pumping to get the water high enough so it can really get up on top of the Great Basin, the whole Great Basin territory involving Utah, Nevada, some of Arizona, Colorado, et cetera, in the center of the west there.
But then, didn't the original design also include use of peaceful nuclear explosives to hollow out areas to limit some of the pumping that's needed?
That's some weird. I need to talk to some people about that because I've heard that was discussed as a possible consideration. I don't know how serious the study was done, but that would be very beneficial for the construction aspect. Just to move the water initially, what they had talked about doing was collecting a huge amount of water up north, and then, like you said, 45% of it would be collected just to then be released back into the ocean again, just to generate the electricity to then run the pumps to pump the rest of the water down into the Southwest and into Mexico. So it inherently had a loss factor of about 45%, where about half the water that they'd have to collect, so they'd have to build larger systems to collect more water just to then run that through a power plant, a hydropower station,
right,
to generate the electricity to then pump the rest of the water. So, you know, it was thinking in those times, you know, coming in the 50s and 60s was what, you know, they could do then. With nuclear power today, we don't need to do that. We can power the pumps with nuclear power plants. And we can, you know, for example, double the water in certain elements of the system, which enables an overall expansion of the whole system. We can bring more water into California and Oregon and into the Central Valley. We can bring water into the High Plains region, where you have this Ogallala Aquifer, which is being depleted at a very frightening rate and needs new water input if we're going to save all the agricultural region, agriculture in this region.
You know, it's interesting you bring up Ogallala, because that's in 1981, I think it was, when I first moved to Houston. We had a conference here in Houston that featured Senator Frank Moss, who was then retired. But he was here, and Lyndon LaRouche was here, and the topic was eventually turned into a paper by LaRouche, "Won't you please let your children have a glass of fresh water?"
Hmm.
Where for the first time, I think for the first time, we took up this NWAPA as a policy issue. And one of the things that was a central part of the discussion, we had farmers, we had ranchers, we had businessmen, and we had some policymakers, including Senator Moss, and a major focus was on this question of the Ogallala Aquifer, which was already, at that point in 1980, becoming more brackish. The water was less useful, less required more treatment before it could be used, and it was being drawn down. And that was one of the concerns that Senator Moss had at the time, was that he said, we're not going to have agricultural land in the area around the Ogallala Aquifer, which has been one of the most fertile, productive areas in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So now here we are, 30 years later, and we're seeing elements of a dust bowl in that area.
Right. Yeah, so it just, and again, the solution, as they had an insight into, is dealing with the whole continental water cycle, the whole continental water system. There's no reason why you should have huge amounts of abundant water up north that don't really participate in much plant life, don't participate in any significant biospheric activity. A lot of this water just falls on the coastal regions and then runs right back off into the ocean. So there's no reason why we can't bring that water down, have it participate in more life, have it cycle through the continent more times in agriculture, in industry, in economic activity, and then re-exit back into the ocean again after having done some productive work. And you really see this clear role with, because as a general concept, that's kind of the general system we're dealing with when dealing with the whole North American water cycle system. And then you see the clear role that what LaRouche has identified as increased energy flux density has, because when you move from a hydropower system to a system driven by nuclear power, you're increasing mankind's capability to do that. With nuclear power, you're increasing mankind's capability to improve the productivity of the whole continental water cycle.
Well, Ben, one of the things then, and I think this is really important to discuss, because just the idea of changing the direction of a river sends environmentalists, off the deep end, because, their view is that in order to stop man's despoiling of nature, as they say, you have to let rivers run wild, which may not be so good for the river or the land.
Yeah.
But then you start adding something, and you say nuclear NWAPA, and their eyes glaze over, and they go completely nuts.
Mm-hmm.
But this question of nuclear power and thermonuclear power is precisely what you're talking about in terms of this necessary upshift or leapfrogging. So I think most of our listeners are aware that of the vast difference in energy flux density between a nuclear power plant and a hydroelectric plant.
Mm-hmm.
But that between nuclear and thermonuclear, the use of fusion, we still don't have fusion as a commercial venture. So when you're talking about this as the future, we're talking about a total change in the whole economy, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is, LaRouche has really been emphasizing taking this whole thing from the future back, really. And you got to ask, what are we going to create with this whole investment to create NWAPA? And the change has to be a creation of a new economy, a new fundamentally higher relationship of man with natural resources. And one of my associates pulled together a statistic that, you know, a study that I think used to be referenced much more, just looking at the example of how many resources are in 1 cubic mile of dirt, just an average cubic mile of dirt anywhere in the United States. And just 1 cubic mile of dirt, which is a lot, but, you know, relative to the whole size of the continent, the whole nation, you know, it's not that much. 1 cubic mile has 200 times the amount of our annual aluminum production, 8 times the amount of our iron production. So 8 times the amount of our total annual iron production just in 1 cubic mile of dirt. That much iron is in there.
But the problem is that it's not very concentrated.
Right. Well, let's get to, 100 times the tin, 6 wow. times the zinc. So there's huge amounts of resources there. But the question is, what defines what's a resource? Mankind defines what's a resource as a function of technology. You know, before we had nuclear power, uranium was just dirt, a rock. It wasn't anything special. When we go to it, when we make these scientific discoveries, then we are able to utilize certain properties, characteristics of this material in a more powerful way. So with a thermonuclear economy, if you go to that level of energy flux density where you can control very, very high temperature plasmas, you can control very high temperature and high density plasma processes, you can begin to process much, much lower quality ores and resources. Yeah, like you said, the in this cubic mile, all that stuff is in there, but it's just very dispersed. It's not concentrated. There's not a big block of iron and a big block of tin. It's all dispersed homogeneously through it. When mankind moves to higher levels of power density, you can process more material to get out the elements you need.
I think LaRouche used to call that increasing the reducing power of your technology.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Because once you get to this very high temperatures, which are plasmas, which are associated with the whole thermonuclear domain, then you can break this stuff down into a plasma state where you break it down just to the basic elements and even the basic isotopes. Mm-hmm. And then you can begin to select out just which elements and isotopes you would like to utilize, you'd like to pull out. And a lot of this stuff has been investigated and studied going back to the 70s and 80s. There were already discussions of beginning to develop some precursor initial systems that would be able to do some of these things for processing lower-grade ores, processing trash, processing waste, and turning this into very valuable resources, getting out the elements from these different things that we want to utilize for economic processes.
Well, Ben, just to make sure I'm not missing something here then, what we're talking about is actually a scientific revolution, because we have not yet been able to effectively contain the power of fusion. So we're talking about more scientists, more research, with implications throughout material processing and so on, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely, and it's going to, you know, and it's a whole set of systems and technologies. I mean, some of these lower temperature plasmas, which could still do a lot, are not beyond current technologies. We can confine certain lower temperature, lower density plasmas for use in industrial resource production, different systems. There was proposals back into the 80s to build some of these initial systems. They wouldn't be as powerful and as intense as a self-sustained fusion process where you're actually getting the fusion of elements, the actual coming together of elements to create new elements. It wouldn't be at that level yet. But in the process of trying to get to that level, we could already begin to utilize some of these higher energy flux density, higher temperature capabilities. And once you go to these higher temperatures, you know, this reference to the reducing power, you begin to open up new capabilities. You could, with very high temperatures, you could do desalination of ocean water much easier.
Mm-hmm.
You could do production of getting hydrogen from water much easier. So you begin to open up whole new abilities to access different elements, different parts of the periodic table in a completely new way, and it is a total revolution. It's a complete revolution in mankind's economic activity.
And actually, this is where you get to the internal absurdity of the environmentalists, who by preventing this technology from developing are actually imposing attrition on human economies.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think it's very, very important the way, you know, Lyndon LaRouche continues to emphasize the whole origin of the environmentalist movement from the British Empire, from a British, it's a strategic policy. It's not a natural movement that came out of nowhere. It comes out of a longer continuity of an imperial policy of population reduction, population control. You know, take the British famous Thomas Malthus and his views on population, take the British policy in imposing famines on India in the 19th century. I mean, this is a longer standing policy, but coming out of World War II, you had the intentional creation of this whole so-called conservation, so-called environmentalist movement, but the entire premise was an imperial premise where they need to limit population growth, reduce the population, ensure third world nations don't become industrial powers, and reduce the living standards down to a lower level throughout the world. I mean, that was the explicit policy governing the movement. And then you have people that get sucked into it, but it's not, if it's not understood that this was the creation from the top down as an intentional strategic policy, people aren't going to get the whole picture.
Well, there's a perfect analogy between that and what we have in modern economics, where you have the policy itself is the cause of the problem. And the same thing with those who are advocating austerity. We've seen the International Monetary Fund acknowledge that austerity is not helping the Greek economy. In fact, it's making it worse.
Right.
And then they prescribe more austerity.
Right.
And you have the same kind of thing where they say, well, there are water shortages, therefore we have to have conferences to figure out how to more effectively use the shrinking supply of water, which makes sense if you've written off the history of mankind.
Well, and even the water conservation ends up having bad effects, because then you don't, if you limit how much water you use, and you don't use a lot of water, you just use a little, you start to do things like not flushing salts and minerals out of the soils. So you start to get an increased buildup of salts and minerals because you don't have enough flow of more water through the area to clean out the soils.
So it worsens the problem they claim they're concerned about.
Yeah, it worsens the problem. It makes the land area worse. You know, whereas if we did Nawapa, not only would we have enough water to, you know, flush the soils and support agriculture and support cities, we could start to support new forests. We could take these totally barren areas and bring in high densities of plant life, of trees, which will then, you know, then, as I was saying, then pull the water back up out of the ground, put it back in the air, create more rainfall, create more cooled local climates, weather systems. Like, mankind can actually understand what life does and help it do it better and do it more and do it over this, you know, if you want to be a so-called supporter of green, you would be a supporter of Nawapa. Nawapa is mankind utilizing the power of plant life and water and the biosphere to improve the land, to make the western part of the whole territory of the North American continent more productive, more biospherically productive.
So they actually should be called Browns, both because of their adherence to Nazi ideology and also because they create more scorched earth.
I certainly think that's appropriate, especially when you consider their policy of putting solar panels throughout deserts. We want to green deserts with Nawapa. They want to line deserts with solar panels, which just capture more heat and radiate more heat and actually increase the temperature of the desert, making it even more difficult for any life to live there.
But that's also their job program, because you'd need to hire an army of people with brooms to sweep the dust off the solar panels.
Yeah.
But Ben, let's go into the future for a moment. We're, let's say, 25 years from now. We have thermonuclear fusion. It's applied to Nawapa. What would these fusion plants look like, and what would they be doing?
Well, I think it's still an open question. I think the first thing that we should do is have, I mean, in my view, I think the first thing that we should do would be have an international conference to call for to design an international Manhattan Project for the development of fusion. there's a whole array of technologies and systems that are either getting just a very little funding today or have just been completely written off because there's not enough money and they won't invest in them. But there's an array of different types of systems. The better known are the tokamak designs, like the ITER, the big international project being built in France, where it's a big donut-shaped torus, where they can confine the plasma within the torus, and they hope that this design will be able to generate power and sustain a fusion reaction to then, begin to give us all the capabilities of fusion power. But there's also other designs, and I think it's, in terms of the actual systems that we end up utilizing, I think it's going to come out of a real crash effort to figure out how fusion works and how to utilize it in the best way. So I think that still needs to be figured out, but what we know...
So before we have fusion, though, we can still go ahead with NWAPA with conventional, maybe fourth-generation or pebble-bed nuclear reactors, fission reactors?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, fusion being a whole economic platform. I mean, we can use fusion in a rather uncontrolled way. We can use fusion for explosives. You mentioned earlier using peaceful nuclear explosives for construction.
Mm-hmm.
We could be using very small thermonuclear explosions to be tunneling through some of the... There's many miles of tunnels that need to be moved. There's a huge amount of earth that needs to be moved to create the canals and tunnels and reservoirs needed for NWAPA to work. Doing it in conventional means will take a certain amount of time. If you apply the higher energy density, just a higher concentration of power you get with a fusion reaction, with the reaction, the combination of elements and releasing energy, you get a much greater concentration of energy per weight of your explosive device, and you can just move more earth more quickly. And it's an expression of the same platform, the same level of economy, where we're beginning to control these higher order processes and put them to work for the benefit of mankind. So we could be using fusion in a kind of brute force, less controlled means relatively soon. There was whole programs studying this back into the 50s that showed this is feasible, economically viable, and would be a much better way of doing large-scale construction projects.
So we're not talking about so-called shovel-ready projects where we're going to take an army of unemployed people and give them shovels and have them go out and start digging in the Rocky Mountain Trench. And I think this is an important point because this gets at one of the things that Lyndon LaRouche took up as an intervention as we saw the auto industry going down in the last decade. And what he said is that we've got to utilize the machine tool capabilities for high-speed rail, building new cities, and so on. So we actually are talking about a very significant jobs program, but not a low-skilled jobs program. We're going to need to develop capabilities that really don't exist at this point in terms of the labor force, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, LaRouche has emphasized repeatedly the whole Franklin Roosevelt precedent. I mean, I think we will need to just begin to put people to work immediately, basically in anything we can get them to do just to begin to rebuild and save the lives of our labor force. And that needs to happen immediately. Just put people to work, get the economy going again. But the real growth factor is going to be high technology, is going to be higher levels of energy flux density. LaRouche has the concept of the productive powers of labor. How productive is each individual laborer, each individual operative in the economy, and how do you change that? How productive is each worker at an auto plant or a maglev manufacturing plant or a steel plant? The way you increase the productivity of each individual person is by going to higher levels of technology, higher levels of capital intensity, where you're providing more technologies and support for the construction process.
Yeah, that's what a machine tool is. A machine tool is something which uses science to increase the power of your industrial processes.
Absolutely. And if you take agriculture and you look at the percentage of the population that's now employed in producing the food for the country, it's much, much smaller than it used to be because each farmer can produce so much more because now they have tractors, now they have advanced seeding systems, now they have advanced ways to take care of the land. So you're having a higher concentration of input of capital intensity of systems provided to aid that individual worker, but then that worker is then incredibly more productive. So the LaRouche has been emphasizing the need for a leapfrog effect to address the current crisis. The way we're going to get out of these decades of attrition, these decades of stagnation and breakdown of the U.S. economy is by pushing farther into the future more rapidly. We need to go towards higher levels of technology, higher, better infrastructure systems, more capital-intensive modes of activity. And that's going to create the growth. That's going to create the increased productivity per operative that's going to allow for a recovery and a supporting of our population.
Now, Ben, one of the things I think this then brings up is the problem that we have from the false economic teachings that dominate academia and politics today, which is someone would say, well, where's the money going to come from to pay for this? And this is why the LaRouche package starts with Glass-Steagall, but includes not just NUWAPA as the driver for it, but a Hamiltonian credit system. Now, your view, as you put forward in the paper, is that this is a policy which more than pays for itself by the increases in productivity, but I'd like you to just discuss that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the key. The key, I think, is seeing them all together as one thing. Hamilton clearly understood this. This has been a core concept understood by the patriotic factions of our country is the role of a credit system, that money just in and of itself, by itself as a thing, doesn't mean anything. Money is it's nothing. It isn't anything by itself. What's real in your economy is your productivity. What are you producing? What effect does your production have on the economy as a whole? What's that relationship? Now, how do you improve that? Now, how do you facilitate those exchanges and those processes? Then money comes in, but money comes in as an expression and a means of facilitation of a physical process. The economy is a physical process. It's a physical science, really. You're looking at how does mankind continue to change his relationship to the biosphere and to the planet and eventually to other planets. So it's a physical science, the way LaRouche has defined it. So then credit comes in as a way of facilitating that. You're providing the credit to invest in the programs that are going to increase your ability to sustain and support and improve your population. And NUWAPA is a perfect example of that. You know, just creating money by itself doesn't mean anything. If you invest credit in NUWAPA, you're saying we're putting forward the means of exchange to allow people to transform the productivity of the entire North American water cycle. We're putting forward the means to facilitate the physical activity of taking a generation to completely transform the territory of the West from the Canadian prairies all the way down into northern Mexico, which will have enormous benefits in the productivity of the nations involved.
So credit really is a part of the process of an increasing dynamic activity.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a way of facilitating actual investment in growth programs, and it's been understood that way by real patriotic forces throughout the history of our country.
Well, it seems to me what we should do is take virtually everyone who's a trained economist right now and give them a job working on NUWAPA for a while so they can actually learn something about economics, because all of economics is right now monetary theory, the attempt to apply various kinds of logarithms to investment policy, which is really just a form of how to game a casino.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and LaRouche's work is key in this. He defined in a completely new way. I mean, other people had insights into it and understood how to work with the system, but he, in a more rigorous and clear way, really discovered and defined human economics as a physical science. You're looking at what is the ability of the creative power of the human mind to act on the universe in a new way and improve the way human society is able to sustain itself through this creative action. And so he's, you know, it is a physical process you're dealing with. So the question is, how do you act upon that? How do you improve mankind's ability to support the economy, support your population?
Well, this is also why you can't do it just from extrapolations of past experience, but you actually have to think from the future. And we have just a little more than 10 minutes left, and I'd like to bring this in to really kind of clarify for people what Lynn means when he talks about you operate from the future. Let's assume that we get Glass-Steagall through and clear out, use Glass-Steagall to break the power of the financial speculators and take away the power of the empire. And then from that standpoint, once we've freed people from this obsession with monetary values, we get to physical economy. And we start building this, and we reopen the auto plants, and we put people to work. 25 years from now, Ben, what are we looking at? What, in your imagination, looking to what we have to do to create a future, what is the future we're looking at then?
Well, I mean, there's a lot there. I mean, I think one thing that's very clear as an option now is some of the international implications. I mean, we're talking about there's already a major shift towards the Pacific, where you have a serious growth orientation in factions in China, Japan, South Korea, Russia, where you have nations that want to do this. They want to move in this direction. They want to improve their territory. Well, if the United States allies with them, you have, with the whole NWAPA project, you also have the whole Bering Strait connection. NWAPA brings you right up into the Arctic, up into Alaska, where you have a 50-mile gap, just a mere 50 miles separating the entire North American landmass from the entire Eurasian landmass. That could be connected with not just rail systems, but maglev rail. We could have, in a generation, we could have a system of magnetic levitation where these trains float on a magnetic cushion, traveling at hundreds of miles per hour. If we're serious and we want to really be able to move people around efficiently, we can have vacuum tube transportation where you actually run these maglev trains in a vacuum tube where you don't have air friction, you don't have to worry about a sonic boom, and you can go thousands of miles per hour. And you could be traveling from the North American continent to the Asian continent, you know, in a matter of hours. You have this whole immense amount of resources in this Arctic territory that are just lying in wait, ready to be developed, all types of precious metals, all kinds of stuff. So we could really turn this entire Pacific Basin into the most productive, advanced development corridor the world has frankly ever seen. If you take a generational cycle and you take the most advanced nuclear power we have available, you take the most advanced infrastructure like maglev rail, which is also great for freight, for moving freight and cargo around more quickly. You take a crash program on fusion, developing a full fusion economy, which is for generating power, but also for these things like processing resources. If we could process trash, dirt, and get out the valuable elements as pure elements, you're completely revolutionizing. I mean, all this discussion of resource shortages is completely different. So we could actually... So that being an embedded program from day one, meaning we could turn this whole corridor from the Pacific coast of the United States up through Canada, up through Alaska, into eastern Russia, down into East Asia. We could turn this whole region into the most productive strip of territory, area of territory mankind has ever created in a generational cycle, if we start from the standpoint of that being the end goal of creating this whole territory with the most advanced technology and infrastructure available.
So we're also talking about, in doing this, getting at one of the fundamental axioms of the environmentalists, which is their idea of the carrying capacity of the Earth, that the Earth can't sustain a growing population. But if you actually look, you know, as I have frequently flown from Houston to the West Coast, and once you get outside of San Antonio, you're looking at nothing but uninhabited land.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's not as though there's a, you know, for people who argue there's a shortage of land, or we're running out of land, they're just completely crazy.
Yeah, it's absurd. And then you got to really ask, and then ask them, what's the carrying capacity of the solar system? what's the carrying capacity of the galaxy? I mean, the idea there's some limit to what mankind can do in terms of expanding out is just totally absurd.
Well, and this comes from the discussion of the whole Trans-Pacific, developing the Trans-Pacific, the Arctic, and so on, that this has immediate implications for this question of extraterrestrial imperative.
Yeah, absolutely, and it all centers around developing a fusion platform. Once mankind can really, and again, a platform, not just for electricity, we're going to need a lot of electricity, obviously, and you want to use fusion power to generate electricity, but also for new materials production, for, as I have said a couple times, for processing resources and completely changing our relationship to natural resources, but also for space transportation. If we're going to get around the solar system, if we're going to defend the Earth from asteroids and comets that we know is just a simple fact are going to hit the Earth again in the future, we're going to it requires the energy density level of fusion power, where your fuel is dense enough that you can actually, that it requires a less mass of fuel on your spaceship to get enough thrust to be able to move around the solar system. I mean, we're really currently, I mean, the way we get around the solar system now is kind of the equivalent of like a horse and buggy or a covered wagon with oxen traveling across the west from the east coast to the west coast of the United States before the Transcontinental Railroad. I mean, we have these chemical propulsion systems where we basically just give these ships a little thrust and then let them float for months or years until they reach their destination. I mean, we're at a very low ability to even move around the solar system. Once you go to fusion, with fusion propulsion, you completely change that. You can constantly accelerate throughout the solar system. You can get to Mars in a matter of weeks. You can begin to move out to some of these other planetary bodies. You can do more exploration. And you can also have the energy density to utilize the resources on these different planetary bodies to begin to construct what would be needed for mankind to sustain himself there at some point in the future. Now, a lot of that can begin to be done remotely with remote systems before we have the ability to really sustain people out there. But we should be thinking, you know, a generation, a century down the line, we should be preparing the way with remote systems, with the development of fusion propulsion, to expand mankind's economic domain well beyond the Earth, to the Moon, to Mars, in a very serious way, where mankind is a force of creative action and development. The way we're talking about developing the North American continent with NOAAPA, we need to apply that level of thinking to the Moon and Mars. We need to be thinking about what level of energy flux density allows us to change the conditions of an entire planetary body to improve it, to make it better, to make it more, to make it able to sustain life, to make it able to sustain human life, to make it able to sustain a productive part of the human economy.
So, Ben, what do we have to do then to get to this future? I mean, what are you going to be doing? What's the basement going to be doing, LaRouche Pack, to get this idea across and then organize the population to support it? What are the plans with? I know this packet you're putting out is obviously a first step in that direction. What else is planned?
Yeah, we have to make this clear. This is the scientific options before mankind. If mankind wants to act as a human in a way that's uniquely human, this is what the future is. It's not, you know, it's kind of funny. I mean, people, we've lived in such a stagnant society for so long. People have a lot of fantasies about the future and, you know, sci-fi and what the future can be. I mean, if you really get down to the science of it, the future is relatively clear. In generalities, you know, not in specifics, but in generalities in the direction, it's there. You just have, we have to make it real for people, and we have to make it clear that the only way we can get there and make this reality occur is by winning the immediate political fight around Glass-Steagall, completely removing the power of Wall Street in this country, removing the power of the Anglo-Dutch Empire on the world, and actually getting an alliance of nations that are committed to this growth program, to moving to a fusion platform, a fusion economy, something we could have begun to do decades ago and was not done for political reasons. Like I said, it's clear what the next steps are in generalities. It's clear what we need to do, and we need to make that, we need to communicate that, communicate why that's the future, why fusion is the future, and then make clear that the only way we can get there is through a political fight to remove these forces from power that are intending to stop that, and to get a new alliance among nations committed in this credit principle idea. We're investing in creating these fundamentally new stages for the improvement of mankind.
Well, for those who want to take a look at this and turn it into your organizing activity, there is on the LaRouchePact.com website your paper from the it's now on the website, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And it's also coming out in the current issue of the Executive Intelligence Review, which anyone can subscribe to. It will, and I'm sure we'll have updates, but also virtually every Wednesday, this kind of discussion, the deeper theory and theoretical discussion to what you're talking about, is covered in what used to be called the Weekly Report. I believe it's now the New Paradigm Show, but that this is part of an ongoing discussion. So every one of our listeners can participate in this and take these ideas and make them your own. Ben, we just have about 2 minutes to go. You want to say anything else just to summarize this discussion?
I mean, I think it's pretty clear. I think we just have to make it clear to people what the future can be scientifically, technologically, if we win the political fight, and then use that passion for the future we want to create, and we must create, use that passion to feed the immediate political fight to remove these guys from power now to get the type of structures in place to make this a reality.
I think it's important to say that the only obstacles to this are really two. One is we have an empire which has been distorting and destroying the notions of science, of real science, whether it's in physical science or physical economy, to create the second obstacle, which is the way most people think. Most people have accommodated themselves to the idea that things are bad and they're getting worse. There's nothing you can do about it because they're too powerful.
Yeah.
And so it's another one of these self-fulfilling prophecies. If you're going to sit on your rear end and complain,
right,
you're never going to change anything.
Well, and we also have a very unique opportunity because that whole paradigm is breaking down so fundamentally and
exactly.
Starkly.
Yeah. And it's breaking down as we're talking, and if people don't get into this fight, you'll have no one to blame but yourself when there's no food, no bank, no money, and no electricity and no water. So, Ben, I'd like to thank you for joining us today, and just to, again, remind people, go to LaRouchePact.com to get this material and start working on it. And Ben, we'll have you back on again at some point in the near future as your work expands and develops. So thanks for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you.
And we'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on The LaRouche Show. Thanks for joining us today, and get your friends involved. So we'll talk to you next week.